I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Dropping out of the Iran nuclear deal has the feel of dropping into the John Bolton phase of the Trump era. Trump in full, Trump extra. The theme is no more Mr. Nice Guy or America first, last, and virtually alone. Multilateral Europe is appalled by unilateral Trump. He pretends to consult and then ignores the old allies, first on climate change, then trade barriers, and now Iran. We've got to stop being wimps, they're saying aloud. But here comes John Bolton with his broad brush mustache and the truculent air of Steve Bannon, except that Bolton is a real neoconservative, a gung-ho regime changer, as Bannon was not. Under Bolton rules, military intervention is in again, with our nukes at the ready. In the Middle East, proxy warfare between Israeli and Iranian forces stepped up immediately in Syria to levels described as extremely dangerous. Meantime, European powers snubbed on that Iran deal sound ready to end a sacred alliance with the U.S. Donald Trump is being ridiculed for breaking one nuclear agreement while chasing another one with North Korea, but the president himself seems to think that his battering of Kim Jong-un these many months is forcing progress, as in the release of American prisoners by North Korea this week. So Trump crowds are starting to chant, "Nobel! Nobel!" And the president affirms them humbly, "The prize I want," he says, "is victory for the world." Steve Walt has the opening round this hour on the wonder and the profound worry at a dicey moment in Trump time. He's a foreign policy analyst at Harvard who's made a trademark of tough-mindedness. We'll also be looking at the wounded Iran nuclear deal through the Persian end of the telescope. And we'll be trying to follow the money through the Trump campaign contributions to see if that is what drives the president's course. First, Steve Walt, you couldn't make this up, but if you could, what would you call it?
I guess I would call it a return to the first term of the George W. Bush administration. Meaning that the United States is back acting in essentially completely unilateral fashion, placing an enormous emphasis on coercion and pressure and threats of military force. And when we turn to the Middle East, it's basically aligning itself with forces promoting regime change. The goal is to use American power to try and transform the region, to get rid of any actors that we don't like, first and foremost Iran. And I think that that's the ultimate motivation behind his decision to tear up the nuclear agreement that had blocked Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
But first, it sounds like so ironic that this is Donald Trump who put all this stuff in Jeb Bush's face and said, "Your brother lied us into a ridiculous war, 30 years of wasted effort and nothing in the Middle East."
Yeah, I think we've learned that Donald Trump is not noted for his consistency. So in that sense, it's not particularly surprising. But I think, again, if you look at what's happened in the last few weeks, it has been Trump not giving us the more restrained foreign policy that he occasionally hinted at, but in a sense, finding his inner neoconservative and embracing very much the agenda of regional transformation that they championed that ultimately led us into Iraq.
But so what was, in that context, what was so wrong with the nuclear deal?
Well, there was actually nothing wrong with the nuclear deal from an American point of view insofar as it stopped Iran from being able to pursue nuclear weapons and would have given the world and the United States ample warning if Iran ever had tried to get out of the deal. And that's, I think, why the Obama administration signed it, why our allies supported it, why Russia and China went along with it and had gone along with the sanctions that helped produce it. The difficulty, of course, was that this also opened the possibility of Iran becoming a more normal country. And that was the intention behind it, that Iran would sign this deal and we would lift the nuclear-related sanctions. Not all the sanctions we had on Iran, but all the ones related to its nuclear program would gradually be lifted. And the hope, I think, both on the Iranian side and amongst many Americans, was that gradually Iran would come out of the penalty box and begin to resume a more normal relationship. And eventually, of course, be recognized as having some legitimate interests in its own region, which, of course, any major power in that region does have a variety of them. This, of course, is anathema to hardliners here in the United States, certainly anathema to hardliners in Israel, anathema, I think, to Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia as well. They want to keep Iran in the penalty box forever, a pariah, economically crippled, and eventually topple the clerical regime in the hopes that that will suddenly give us an ally in Iran again.
We got to get to this matter of why Iran is, for those people, an existential problem. It's just because it is there. It is who it is. But first, the nuclear deal was Barack Obama's great monument in foreign policy. But I'm wondering how great a monument was it? How good a deal, unratified, a very personal triumph that was gone as soon as Obama was gone, undone by Bibi Netanyahu, by Prince Salman of Saudi Arabia, and Donald Trump together. I mean, that's not a great deal that so easily evaporates.
Well, it was an executive agreement, or even sort of in some respects less than that, because, of course,
which is to say that the Congress had no stake in it, that we hadn't really heard it debated.
We had certainly heard it debated. It was extensively debated. It was quite controversial, and of course, it didn't get a single Republican vote, which is why you couldn't have ratified the treaty. It would have been better to do it as a formal treaty, but it would never have happened if that had been the standard we had to reach. Of course, nobody anticipated Donald Trump winning this particular election. Most people expected Hillary Clinton to win. She would have undoubtedly kept the agreement. She would have kept pressure.
Not a giant champion of the agreement, though.
No,
right?
No, but she was a clear supporter of it. She would have definitely kept it. She would have kept pressure on Iran as well, as I think Obama would have if he'd had a third term, would have continued to push Iran on other matters. So Trump's arrival was, unfortunate from the point of view of the deal. But the point I'm trying to make here is that you're right. The main flaw of the deal was not its terms themselves, but the fact that it was so easily overturned once you had a president who didn't understand its virtues.
Steve, if it's a one-flaw deal, can it be fixed even now?
I don't think so at this stage. I think Trump is clearly dead set against it. His closest advisors have long been dead set against it. The Europeans, who were also parties to the agreement, and let's remember this is a multilateral agreement with lots of countries having signed up for it. The Europeans have spent the last 5 months trying to persuade Trump to retain the deal and offering various ways that it could be improved or modified. He ultimately rejected all of their efforts, basically, I think, treating them with complete contempt. So at this point, I think one has to consider American participation in this agreement dead and buried. And now we'll see what the other parties do in response to the United States leaving it, ultimately reimposing sanctions. The Europeans and the Iranians have both said in the short term they will abide by its terms. But whether or not that actually is sustainable, again, remains to be seen.
With the George W. Bush experience behind everybody to universal regret, the question, urgent question in my head is, what happens when the superpower goes rogue? Who's to put a citizen's arrest on him or on us? And especially, who in Europe is about to stand up and say, we've seen this movie before, it's a disaster?
Right. Well, you are certainly getting a number of European voices expressing great concern, but also great anger at being treated in this fashion. Whether it's Emmanuel Macron or Angela Merkel or Theresa May, the leaders of the three most significant European powers, they all tried to persuade Trump in a very accommodating way, and they got nowhere. And so you are hearing voices now out of Europe saying we have to stop this.
Voices, but not a voice. Henry Kissinger used to say about the Muslim world, who do I call? Well, give me the phone number.
The European, the EU High Commissioner for Foreign Affairs has been quite outspoken in defending the deal and saying that Europe has to stand up for itself. But the issue will come when the United States basically threatens to impose secondary economic sanctions on any European businesses or banks that are in some way doing business with Iran. And that's been the principal club we have used to browbeat the Europeans. And thus far, Europeans have never been willing to really go toe-to-toe with us and make us pay a price for doing that. And my prediction is that my prediction is this time around that will be the same, that the Trump administration administration assumes that Europeans will complain, they'll be angry, they'll be upset in a variety of ways, but at the end of the day, they will fold and let the United States go down this, in my view, unwise road.
Meantime, Kim Jong-un seems to be approaching talks. Donald Trump, I'm sure, thinks he's got the Koreans eating out of his hand by now, and he's talking Nobel. I mean, what does that tell you? Who's smoking what?
Well, none of us, actually, I think. We all have to be appropriately humble because what's happened with Korea is surprising to many people. But, of course, nothing that's happened so far is substantively important. It's very good that, for example, today three American prisoners in North Korea were released and came home, and that's wonderful. But that's not strategically significant. The big question here is sort of twofold. Will there be some kind of peace agreement between North Korea and South Korea? And secondly, will there be some sort of change in the nuclear status of North Korea? And of course, Kim has not said any of those things yet. He has hinted that he's willing to talk about North Korea's nuclear weapons. But of course, North Korea has said that multiple times in the past. So whether or not we'll actually make any progress.
But he's got the attention of the Japanese and the Chinese. But what is the chance, I'm wondering, that Kim Jong-un thinks he's got Trump eating out of his hand?
Well, I think so far, if you were scoring this, you would say the score is Kim 1, Trump 0. Because, of course, when Kim invited Trump to sit down and meet with him face-to-face, Trump immediately accepted, giving Kim something his father never got and his grandfather never got, namely a face-to-face meeting with the most powerful leader in the world, treating him as an equal. Right? And what did he give up to get that meeting? Absolutely nothing. So right now, Kim is actually in a better position than Trump is.
You mean they've been waiting all these years for
this is a
look at the Oval Office?
Its point is it's the photo op of these two leaders sitting side by side talking as equals. That's an enormous win for Kim. And again, he didn't have to give up anything to get that.
We're talking with Steve Walt to begin about scorecards after the end of the Iran nuclear agreement. Coming up, a bit of historical guidance going back to Alexander the Great as to the West's hang-ups about those Persians and Iran's hang-ups about us. This is Open Source. Ervand Abrahamian is an eminent historian and teacher of the Iranian perspective on the world all around it. He's taught at Oxford, Princeton, now the City University of New York. There are at least two views, Professor, that we probably ought to distinguish this week: views of the Revolutionary Islamic Republic, the mullahocracy that's been in power for 40 years now, but then the views of ordinary people, many of whom hate their government and would love to resist it. What does Iran hear in all this talk by way of a threat? Threat of sanctions, threat of regime change, threat of war?
Well, I think people in Iran would have actually heard the speech 2 days ago as really an implicit declaration of war and an explicit demand for unconditional surrender. So I think they're already, especially the diehards, seeing this as a basic confrontation. But what the expectation in Washington is somehow the system is going to crumble. And I think what they forget is Iran is very different from many of the other neighboring countries. This country has 2,000-year history there. It has a very strong identity. It has a common culture, common history, common religion. People may have political differences, but when it comes to seeing the nation in danger, people are likely to rally around the government and even maybe rally around more diehard people to oppose threats from outside. So this type of threat is not going to actually weaken the regime. It's going to strengthen it. And their expectation, I think their planning, is that, well, economic measures, the sanctions, will cause such economic hardship that this will lead to protests and uprisings and so on. Again, it's a miscalculation. Iran has been through actually quite a hard economic crisis in recent decades. And what the, besides Iran having a strong national identity, it has actually created a very strong centralized state. And we saw that during the Iraqi war. What the state was able to do, even with tight belt tightening and shortages, it was very effective, actually, as effective as a country like Britain during World War II, in basically distributing these scarce goods through rationing and making sure that they were not actually economic real hardships. So this type of threats is not going to actually bring down the regime. It will strengthen the regime. And that's going to create another problem, because then the ball will be in the U.S. court. What are they going to do if they want to get rid of the regime and economic pressures are not doing it? So then they'll have to escalate to actually bombing the maybe the nuclear installations if Iran has then at that point gone into enrichment, or actually military ventures. And that really leads to a nightmare situation, because it's a far more serious situation than Iraq. The country
also
is much bigger, the geography is much harder, the, as I said, the national identity is much stronger, and you're going to have an invasion of an army of about 2 million men to be able to control the country indefinitely. So it's if you follow our logic down the road, it's really a disaster.
Steve Wald, this regime change thing goes back. I mean, early in the Iraq time, it was half a joke, but I think it was serious in Paul Wolfowitz's time that, you know, every man wants boots down in Baghdad, but real men want boots down in Tehran. We got to do something about those Iranians. What is this hang-up? We'll hear more from Professor Abrahami, but what's your professional view?
Well, because Iran has been a thorn in the side of the United States since the Iranian Revolution, of course. We've been a thorn in Iran's side.
We've been a dagger in their side. I mean, from 1953, I marvel that we talk so little about the original sin, which was overthrowing their very promising democracy after World War II.
But certainly the Iran, I think, was the big prize with the neocons' program of regional transformation. They wanted to get rid of Syria. They wanted to get rid of Saddam. But Iran was, I think, as you said, the big prize. But the point is, this is all based on this idea that the United States can, with various forms of pressure and especially military power, run different countries. We can reorder the politics of an entire region. And this never works. If you just look at the historical record, right, Israel tried to do that in Lebanon in the 80s. They end up with Hezbollah there. The United States tried to do it in Iraq. We got ISIS. We tried to do it
What is wrong with us, Steve Wald?
What's wrong with us?
That we don't learn a single thing.
We're so powerful and so secure, we can afford to be stupid, and we can afford to engage in repeated acts of historical amnesia.
But if that neoconservative fantasy is not dispelled by the record in Iraq, what in the world, other than total, you know, world destruction, can drive the lesson home?
Well, I think it's in part because the people who gave us Iraq were never held accountable for it. They left the Bush administration, went back to the same think tanks where they began to sell the same snake oil that we're now seeing back again, you know, a dozen years later. And until the United States comes better at sort of holding individuals accountable, but also learning the correct lessons from its mistakes and also from the things it does right, we're going to repeat the same errors over and over.
Ervand Abrahamian, speak to the view that comes out of Israel and Saudi Arabia, Steve Wald alluded to it, that the problem is not Iran's weapons, it's Iran. Iran itself, as you say, an ancient, unified country of 80 million people, extraordinarily young, sophisticated, aware of the West, but seen to be resentful and difficult. How does Iran see itself, and how does it confront that tag in the world?
Well, Iran, as I said, it's very nationally aware. It's very solidified in terms of identity. But Iranians are not obsessed about real recent history. They know what U.S. did in 53. They know recent imperialism and so on. So their premise is there's an outside threat always, but they're not sort of emerged into constant history analysis of what's happening. They're much more concerned about the present, and that's why when Rouhani started to open up to the West, the public was very much in support of that. So they're not. If it comes to a question of, let's say, improving relations with Britain or United States, they're not going to say, well, history is against this. They're much more willing to do it.
Why don't we feel that? Why don't we feel that on the nuclear deal, for example, they might have curbed their ballistic missiles? They might have agreed to certain, you know, rules of behavior in the neighborhood, so to undo the threat, whether Hezbollah or Yemen or elsewhere, that they're going imperial.
Well, this is again exaggeration of the Iran's what the term is often now used is hegemony. I mean, it's absurd. Iran has allies in the region. Allies are actually threatened on Assad was really on life support. So Iran had to support Assad. It wasn't really Iran strengthening its position in the Mediterranean. It was really fighting to keep its ally in existence. So it has allies. But to argue that Iran is therefore imperial power reaching outwards is a gross exaggeration.
Sure, and I don't mean to parrot it, but still, I wonder if the country, the population, is as friendly and as interested in the West as you say. Why don't we see it?
Why don't we see it?
Yeah. Why don't we feel it? But maybe that's an unanswerable question. Speak of what feels like a terrible threat in Syria today of Iranian weapons and Israeli weapons going too far.
Well, you know, Iran has had long-term alliance with Assad. To expect Iran to suddenly ditch Assad is just not feasible. Countries can't do that. They have a commitment to Assad. You have to remember, when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, the only important country in the Arab world that supported Iran was Assad. So they have this commitment to Assad. And again, there's a lot of noise about how mischievous Iran is in supporting Assad. But you have to think realistically. Would U.S. have wanted the jihadists to take over Damascus? Sure, Assad is not a nice guy, but would you prefer actually jihadists in Damascus, whose main actually goal was, their slogan was Christians to Lebanon, Alawis to the grave. So they were actually advocating genocide. So even during the Obama period, when people were talking about Assad should go, they were not really understanding the implications of that.
Do we get a
What is often described as, you know, Iran's mischievous behavior in the region is actually beneficial behavior. Again, they played a major role in helping Iraq to get rid of the caliphate up in Mosul. So again, is that mischievous behavior to fight against the jihadists in Mosul?
The question really is, what's the risk now of an escalation?
It's very high.
Not just
in Syria. I mean, there is the Syria's in the news, but I think as if the U.S. then escalates the question about putting more and more pressure on Iran, Iran can retaliate in areas where the U.S. is weak, and a number of places in the Middle East where U.S. is weak. And that is going to actually then lead to the U.S. having to make the decision, do we withdraw from places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, or do we send in more troops there to counter the deteriorating situations there? So Trump is going to end up in a position he claimed he never wanted to be, which is getting deeper immersed in militarily in the Middle East.
Steve Walt.
Yeah, I agree with this last point, that military action does have a dynamic of its own, and it often leads you into places you didn't realize. A while back you mentioned, you know, why can't Iran follow some rules of behavior? It's not clear to me what those rules of behavior would be. What rules are we talking about? Are we talking about Saudi Arabia bombing civilians in Yemen? We don't seem to be upset by that violation of rules of behavior. Are we talking about Israeli snipers shooting civilians in Gaza? That seems to be kind of objectionable according to rules of behavior. So there are things we don't like that Iran is doing, but what the United States and its friends in the Middle East have never been willing to acknowledge is that Iran is, in fact, a substantial regional power. It's a country of, 80-some million people with enormous potential, and it has interests. It does not want to have all matters in the region determined unilaterally by others. So, for example, when the Syrian civil war broke out and they were trying to convene a peace conference to discuss how it might be settled, the Obama administration, and this was, I believe, Hillary Clinton's decision, said no, but Iran couldn't attend. Right. They weren't invited.
Penalty box again.
Yeah, keep them in the penalty box. So what this, of course, guaranteed was that you were not going to get any agreement because Iran had some influence over the region. They certainly had influence with Assad. If you wanted to settle the Syrian civil war at an early stage where far fewer people had died, you had to have all of the relevant actors there. And the United States, for the past 30 years or more, has wanted to keep Iran as far away as possible. And I believe much of what Iran does in the region is its way of reminding us that we're here. This is our part of the world. It's really not your part of the world. It's our part of the world. We're not going anywhere. And therefore, we have certain interests. We're not trying to take the place over. I agree entirely. This notion that Iran is trying to establish hegemony of the region is, in fact, absurd. But they're not going away. And our efforts to continue to press them and eventually to overthrow them, I believe, are not going to succeed. But even if they do succeed, they're not going to improve the circumstance because any subsequent Iranian regime is going to want to defend a certain set of interests as well.
You know, you're both reminding me of the Iraq War, and one maybe cynical, but I thought illustrative analysis of why it happened. The Arab Muslim world has many kinds of sizes and shapes of countries, but some have oil, some have population, some have water. Iraq had all three. Therefore, it's an entity, it's an existential problem. Iran, furthermore, is in the same position. It, by definition, as who it is, a Shia state with an enormous history and population, is by definition standing there waiting for the Saudis and the Israelis to do something about it, and us.
But my point is they're going to find that they've got more than they can chew with Iran. I mean, they could destroy Iraq, but with Iran, it's a different matter.
Steve?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, just to notice some of the differences. So Iran is principally Shia, which causes some tensions in certain periods with Sunni states. Iran is Persian, not Arab. That's a problem. Iran has a more participatory form of government, right? You compare Iran's government, which is hardly a democracy as we would define it, but it has greater political participation. It has elections that really do matter in the sense that the presidency changes when the voters vote. You don't see something like that happening in the Gulf states or in Saudi Arabia as well. And as Professor Abramanian said, it's also got a very proud national culture. This looks rather threatening to other countries in the region.
How do we take the threat out of it is to me the question. We're totting up scores all over the world in the aftermath of Donald Trump's exit from the Obama-Iran nuclear containment agreement. With Steve Walt and Ervand Abrahamian in New York. Coming up, follow the money was Deep Throat's advice that broke the Watergate story and Richard Nixon's presidency. Is there a money story yet that explains Donald Trump? This is Open Source. Open Source is an independent program funded by our listeners. Please visit our website for more information on how to make a donation to the hardest working team in radio. Sign up for our newsletter. Subscribe to our podcast. Join the conversation at radioopensource.org. Our guest, Eli Clifton, published a remarkable piece of research and reporting online this week. Welcome, Eli. You made the Trump bailout from the Iran nuclear deal almost simple. It was the handiwork, you wrote, essentially, of three multi-billionaires who had contributed massively to Donald Trump's campaign and knew exactly what they wanted in return. Would you just tell us that story?
Well, in a nutshell, it's pretty easy to track that, you know, Donald Trump, when we really go and look back at his candidacy, he didn't necessarily espouse, while he certainly had a hostility towards pretty much everything that Barack Obama did, the fact that he would pull out of the nuclear deal by no means seemed like a foregone conclusion. Remember, I was just looking at his Twitter account, and in January of 2016, he was complaining about that the thing that he disliked the most about the nuclear deal was that it looked like Iran was going to spend more on Airbus planes than on Boeing planes with the money that they would get from sanctions relief. So obviously we went a long way, but something happened between January of 2016 and the inauguration. And I think that thing happened right around when Trump won the nomination. And at that point in time, he secured the support and the endorsement of the Republican Party's biggest donor, Sheldon Adelson. And Adelson has been very outspoken about his views on Iran. He's advocated for the concept of launching a nuclear weapon at the Iranian desert, as he put it, just to let them know that we're serious about wanting to negotiate about their nukes. And have proposed that as a negotiating technique, again, to force them to denuclearize, we should nuke Tehran or threaten to. So he's been very outspoken about his views on these matters.
Sheldon Adelson, I just want to say, I mean, one-time taxi driver in the city of Boston. Also, just before January 2016, he's the man that Donald Trump tweaked Marco Rubio about. He said, you know, Marco, you're just a little toy in the hands of Sheldon Adelson. What brought Trump and Adelson together?
Clearly, it was winning the nomination and not a whole lot else, because I don't think that they saw eye to eye on very much. Trump probably liked Adelson because he was richer than he was, so that was always something to admire and somebody whose respect he wanted. But at the end of the day, they really did come from rather different places. But that said, Adelson has been a big investor in the Republican Party, has been a big investor in think tanks in Washington, like those that Professor Walt was just talking about, where people who were the Iraq War architects went and found very cushy jobs, as opposed to being banished outside of policymaking circles, like some people would suggest they should have been. And in this case, Adelson saw an opportunity, I think, to invest heavily in Donald Trump's candidacy. He invested $35 million in outside spending, which in theory would be untraceable money, but he has acknowledged that there was about $35 million spent. And based off of what we know, that actually makes him Donald Trump's biggest campaign supporter. We don't hear that very often. We hear a lot about Robert Mercer. We hear a lot about the Koch brothers. But Adelson is far and away number one. He, alongside his wife, Miriam Adelson, whose influence should not be understated.
In your story, there was $35 million to the Trump campaign, $20 million to the House Republican campaign, $35 to the Senate Republican campaign. I mean, these numbers are almost unbelievable. This is a very rich man. He got a billionaire in Las Vegas, a super billionaire in Macau off the coast of China, casinos and this sort of thing, which makes him sound a bit like a pawn of the Chinese, too. I mean, they could end that casino, dry that up overnight if they wanted. But introduce the others. Bernard Marcus, Paul Singer.
Bernard Marcus is the co-founder of Home Depot. He would be, in terms of direct contributions to the campaign, and I should emphasize that you said that Adelson gave $35 million to the campaign. It was not to the campaign. It was outside spending to support the campaign, if we care to make these distinctions. So Robert Mercer would have been the first in terms of contributing to super PACs supporting Donald Trump, which I believe was around $15 million. And then the second largest sort of campaign contributor, as it were, would be Bernie Marcus at around $6 million, $6 or $7 million to support the Trump campaign. Now, Paul Singer held off. He's another very hawkish billionaire hedge funder here in New York City. But he came around at the very end and contributed $1 million to the inauguration, despite having funded the initial research by Fusion GPS that formed the basis for the Steele dossier, which alleged all sorts of contacts and connections between Donald Trump's campaign and businesses and Russian oligarchs. Now, all three of them together in their contributions to the House and Senate leadership funds, which are essentially the Republican Party's super PACs, the biggest spenders of campaign money to support their winning of a majority in both houses. The combined, it was around 45% in both of those funds were provided by these three individuals. And these three individuals have an extensive philanthropic history, as I was saying, of supporting the think tanks that laid, I believe, the groundwork for pulling out of the nuclear deal.
Eli Clifton, you concluded in your piece that Donald Trump and the Republican Party, all of us really, are effectively captive to a small cohort of hawkish billionaires dead set on steering this country away from any sort of detente with Iran. Even a multilateral agreement that ensures limits on enrichment and subjects the Islamic Republic to invasive inspections of its nuclear facilities. So how did the deal get done? Mr. Trump, you've got to end Obama's sellout to Iran. I mean, how is it framed? And how did Sheldon Adelson come to have breakfast in the White House the day after Trump did the deed?
Well, I think to understand, perhaps to give the most, as it were, conspiratorial or nefarious portrayal of what occurred, sure, we should look at the fact that Sheldon Adelson had breakfast in the White House the day after Donald Trump accomplished the thing that Sheldon Adelson had been pushing for years. But let's also ask what happened 1 week ago when Paul Ryan went to Las Vegas and secured a $30 million contribution to the Congressional Leadership Fund from Sheldon Adelson. So let's not forget that that happened a week ago, that Adelson again came in being the biggest donor to the Republican Party. And if Donald Trump wants to move forward in his legislative agenda, he's going to need majorities in both houses, and he's going to need somebody who can whip votes for him in both houses. And, you know, even more nefariously, if and when the possibility of an impeachment occurs, he's going to need somebody who can essentially work the strings of all Republican members of the House. Now, when you put all that into context, you can see how Sheldon Adelson has a great deal of leverage over Donald Trump, both politically as well as in any number of other ways.
I want to ask Ervand Abrahamian, what does an Iranian learn about the practice of American politics these days?
Well, I think someone like Zarif, the foreign minister, is knows the ins and outs of American politics. I don't think the average general public knows the complexities of it. I mean, they know that there are pressures, especially from Israel, but how the differences between Democrats, Republicans, and after actually when Obama was elected, they first really the press in Iran miscalculated. They thought he was just pursuing a Bush policy, and it took them a while to realize that he was actually willing to negotiate. So they don't follow these very complicated issues there.
It's pretty simple, though, and I wonder how many Americans understand it, that the Koch brothers are not the only owners of our politics these days. What do you make of it, Steve Walt?
Well, I think the key lesson here...
I'd like to add one thing here. You know, these three billionaires, they're much more allied to the Netanyahu Likud branch of Israeli politics, who've always considered Iran as an existential threat. But within Israel, which is something that Americans don't realize, if you talk to former leaders of Mossad, former prime ministers, former generals, there is a consensus, really, that there is no Iranian threat. And they are actually...
True. They were for the agreement.
They were for the agreement.
As was our Pentagon.
Yeah. So, you know, this voice, I would say the realistic voice in Israel is not heard of. All is heard is Netanyahu talking about Iran's imminent danger and so on. And these billionaires basically feed into that.
Sheldon Adelson owns a newspaper, a very, very right-wing newspaper in Israel. He's very, very close to Netanyahu as well. What are you learning, Steve, if anything?
Well, I think this is an old story that various aspects of U.S. foreign policy are, in fact, for sale, more so than they used to be. And I think Americans really need to ask if, you know, we want to remain bogged down in the Middle East essentially forever because a small number of very wealthy businessmen, very hawkish billionaires, have a particular view of what our policy should be, and they are able, in a variety of different ways, which Eli has described very nicely, to shape both what presidents think but also shape what people in the Congress think, or at least shape their interests. And the other point we ought to just keep in mind is, you know, sort of who's the big winner? Well, obviously, you know, I assume Netanyahu probably thinks he won this week. But the real big winner in events of the last week or so is, I think, been China. Because after all, this is going to ensure that the United States continues to have problems in the Middle East, where we've already squandered trillions of dollars in the last decade or more. We're going to remain distracted by things in the Middle East in ways that will keep us from focusing on the much more serious challenge, long-term challenge we may face from China. Of course, this move pushes Iran to move closer to China and also to Russia because it has no alternative now. And we may even have been lost some support we might have wanted from Europe. Our European allies are not going to be as inclined to back us up if we get into a serious confrontation with China over time. So I imagine that people in Beijing, woke up having heard the president's speech thinking this is exactly what they wanted to hear. It ensures that the United States, you know, once again will have inflicted a wound upon itself.
Before we give it all away to China, I mean, we're talking about scoring the week. I would say Bibi got the basket, Salman from Saudi Arabia gets an assist, and Barack Obama, I'm sorry, you weren't really in the game. I mean, isn't it at least Bibi won, Barack zero on this round? And I say that as a rooter for the agreement and for President Obama almost across the board.
Yeah, I think you could certainly score it that way. But it's also not clear, of course, that this it may be in the short term. You know, at the end of the first quarter, it's BB1. But the consequences of this remain to be seen. And it's easy to imagine consequences between Iran and Israel and others. Well, for example, it's easy to imagine that Iran over time decides that it has to restart its nuclear program. And it looks and sees the respect that North Korea is now getting because it has a nuclear arsenal and the way Iran is being treated. So it decides what we really need to do is get across the threshold, or at least get very, very, very close to having a bomb of our own. That's how we get respect. This week, Saudi Arabia indicated that they wanted to start moving down that road if Iran did. So if you're Israel and you suddenly ask yourself, where were we under the agreement? This is what, as Professor Abramanian said, Israeli national security experts believe the agreement was good for Israel, right? Because it kept Iran from getting a nuclear bomb, which then meant Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. wouldn't have to get a nuclear bomb. You can imagine Israel waking up in 10 years and suddenly it has several neighbors with nuclear weapons, and its relations with those neighbors are not necessarily warm and friendly. So this, in fact, at the end of the first quarter, maybe Netanyahu 1, Obama 0, but this game may have more than one quarter in it.
Professor Abrahamian, in Iran, what will the impulses be to restart a bomb program, as Steve Walt just suggested, or to restart a no-nukes negotiation?
Well, the possibility of negotiations is not there, because if you read Trump's speech, he basically isn't giving an alternative. He's asking Iran to basically surrender, change all its policy across the board, and that's not really negotiable. Iran is not going to restart enrichment right away. They're going to wait to see what the Europeans do. If the Europeans actually stand up against United States and say we're going to continue to trade and invest, then they'll just ignore United States and keep to the agreement. If, however, Europe buckles under, and I think Walter's right, they might buckle under because of economic problems and their fear of having access to United States markets. Once they do that, there will be strong pressure from the diehards in Iran to start the nuclear program. Rouhani would either have to accept that and do it, or in the next elections he will be replaced by someone like Ahmadinejad or someone worse who will go full speed for enrichment. And then the ball will be in the U.S. court. What is U.S. going to do? Is it going to bomb, or is it going to invade the country to stop the Iran getting a nuclear bomb? So, I mean, it's a no-win situation for United States in the long run.
Eli Clifton, I want your impolite reading of your own story. I mean, does it not tell us that Israel calls the tune in an American foreign policy in both parties?
I think that there certainly is ample evidence, and as was pointed out earlier, that it's not just Israel, it's the Likud party in Israel that has maintained some very good connections to some of the more hawkish figures in Washington and the people who fund them. But I think that another direction to point sort of the focus here is that the point is that this happened under all of our noses, and that the people who follow closely with campaign finance very closely tend not to focus their analysis on the foreign policy impacts of donors for reasons that I think are somewhat cultural. There's a political climate in the United States where we believe that politics ends at the water's edge and that foreign policy is a bipartisan endeavor. And if that was ever true, it's no longer true. And we need to start talking about the foreign policy decisions that are made in the context of money and politics and of conventional lobbying and of think tanks. And, you know, it's not just people like Sheldon Adelson and Bernie Marcus and Paul Singer. There's also the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who have done a very good job of ingratiating themselves with some of the more hawkish figures in Washington through financing of think tanks.
Eli,
so we need to start talking about this in the way that we talk about other interest groups as well.
I got to let Steve Walt have a last word on my last word, which is, among other things, of the lessons are, Europe is sort of over in the big game, and Iran, you're still a problem. And then, as you say, let China take it all.
I think that's basically right. Although, if one thing we've understood about this presidency is it's filled with surprises, and maybe some of the countries you just mentioned will surprise us.
So come back next week. Thank you, Eli Clifton, Ervand Abrahamian, and Steve Walt. Thanks also to Hus Banai. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Doné, Jane Yang, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our boss. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.